Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Heidi E.Y. Stempel. She has published more than 35 books and numerous short stories and poems, mostly for children. And her latest book is Wren's Nest. Heidi, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hi, how are you? I'm glad to be on your show.
You know, I'm going to say this for the benefit of the public. I'm totally embarrassed. I haven't had you on until now. It's just an oversight. It wasn't anything other than that. But, you know, Obviously you're an important and prolific children's book writer. And I'm glad we're getting to talk about Wren's Nest. Before we move on, I want to talk about the illustrator, who's Eugenia Nobody.
Yes, Eugenia is amazing, isn't she?
Have you worked with her before?
I have, but I don't choose the illustrator. So it's a funny story because Eugenia was chosen to do, my mom is author Jane Yolen, and we did two nonfiction poetry books together, which are called Eek You Reek and Yuck You Suck, and they were done, I know, right?
I love that.
Extremely scientific way. In the meaning of the word. And she did these wonderful animals. They're hilarious. They are accurate in their way, but also they're doing funny things because the poems themselves are nonfiction, but also lighthearted.
I could never have guessed with Eek You Reek and Yuck You Suck. Is that like,
hoping for a third.
I know. I was going to say there's got to be a trilogy.
We're working on Cool You Drool, but that is the publisher has not even seen it yet, so we don't know whether that will be a book. But they are a delight to work on because we both love writing poetry and we both love nonfiction, so it's such an easy combination. But they're all done with humor. But Eugenia was sent with several different illustrators and. Everyone loved her stuff. So we chose her, and when I say we were asked our opinion. We had no actual choice. The publisher generally picks the illustrator. And fast forward to years later, I'm working with a different publisher, Familius, which is a small publisher who I adored working with. This is my first book with them, but I have another one in the works with them. And they sent me sketches of the artists they chose, and I said, this looks familiar. And I emailed back saying, who is the artist? And they told me, and I was just absolutely delighted. And it is completely a different style. Eugenia is brilliant, completely different style. And her people, because I hadn't seen her people because the other book was all animals, are so wonderfully quirky. They're almost bent in a way. Someone said it's reminiscent of one of the Pixar movies.
Oh, yeah. Balloons.
I can't remember. And I love it. I think that the cover is a work of art. When I opened the page, the first little piece of spot art is binoculars. Mm-hmm. And anyone who knows me knows it's no surprise that any grandpa who loves birds or any dad who loves birds in stories is my dad, Dave Stempel.
Yeah.
Who we lost getting close to.
And I knew Dave. I knew Dave really well.
Yeah. So he was the bird guy. And the binoculars being on that front piece just absolutely made me cry. When we had my dad's memorial, his binoculars stood up at the front. Nice. So it was a very iconic thing for me, and she did not know that. But, yeah.
What happened? Now, you know, whenever I interview a young people's author or artist, mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by the business because I don't think a lot of people who buy the books understand how sometimes very difficult and complex the young people's books business is. You know, you talked about you had no choice of who's going to illustrate your work. To many people, that would sound odd, but that's the way it is for most of the time.
Yes, and I
so have you and without mentioning
my entire life.
I was going to say without mentioning any names. Have you ever been matched up with somebody that you really thought was not the best?
No.
Heidi.
That's the magic of it, right? You have something in your head while you're writing. You know, of course, Grandpa looked like my dad when I was writing it. And then, if you're a seasoned writer, you know to let go. You know to let
you're right,
go
you're right.
because of the magic that you know is going to show up. The best day for any picture book writer who doesn't do their own illustrations is when those first sketches come in. Because what happens, at least this is for me, I mean, obviously I can't speak for everybody, but any ideas I had in my head absolutely just vanish. They vanish because these characters that only lived in your head become fleshed out. They really have a personality, and that takes on everything that you see in your head. I am continuously flabbergasted by how much deeper your story becomes when it is translated by an artist. And for the most part, without any input from me, and it's so much better that way because a good illustrator puts an extra layer of storytelling in your book, teaches you stuff about your characters that you didn't even know. So it's almost like you're getting reintroduced to your characters, and they are fully fleshed out, fully formed in a way that you could have never done. I have a verse novel coming out at the beginning of next year. I'm terrified.
Really?
How am I going to know what the people? How am I going to know what my characters look like without an illustration? I feel very naked. It's just me. Nobody is sharing that storytelling with me. So it'll be an interesting process.
Well, but what about the cover?
Well, I've seen the artist that they're thinking about for the cover.
And?
So we'll see what happens, but it could
okay, be. Okay, whoa. That sounded guarded.
No. I'm excited, but it may be just graphics. A lot of books don't have, you know, your character on the front. It would be just...
So
text or,
did I hear right?
In this
right,
case, a bird or a car. It could be anything.
Is this nonfiction or fiction?
The verse novel is fiction.
Okay,
and is yeah, and Rensdas is completely fiction as well.
Well, okay, but I want to get back to dealing with Eugenia Nabati because she lives in Argentina, Buenos Aires.
She does.
Right? Great place to bird, by the way, Heidi.
Oh, yeah, that's a dream.
I did a 3-week trip, just my wife and I, to Argentina, and went down from Tierra del Fuego all the way up to the Rio Piranha. And I'll tell you, it blew my mind. But, understanding about, and again, trying to educate the audience about how, did she send you original sketches for your approval, or she just did the whole book entire and then sent you the finished illustrations for the book?
It is entirely done. I have never met Eugenia. I have now talked to Eugenia only on Instagram.
Wow.
Because I wanted to tell her how much I loved her art. So I just reached out to her. I never get involved. So when the editor sent me her sketches, you see there's a buffer there.
Okay.
The editor sent me her sketches. Now, there are some pieces of Wren's Nest. So the story, if you're listening and haven't read the book, is about Wren, a little girl whose grandpa has taught her about birding, and they have put a Wren's Nest outside her window, and she's grown up with that. The family is expanding. They move to a bigger house away from the meadow that they've lived in, into a house in more in the city, not in the city, but and then there are no wrens, and what she does to but so when they sent the art, I said two things. Can Sammy Cat, there's a cat character in the story, can Sammy Cat remain indoors, please? Because Grandpa's a birder, and birders believe, for the most part, not across the board, but for the most part, cats should be indoors. So can Sammy Cat remain indoors? That was just a little thing. And also a wren's box where wrens, you can hang up and wrens like to nest in it. The hole is smaller. Can you fix that? And those, you see how those were little, just tiny little things. But I don't say, Grandpa shouldn't look like that.
Okay.
Or Wren's hair should be a different color because those aren't my choices. So that's how it worked. And then I started to get a series of the final art once the editor and art director okayed her sketches. I do not, we say in writing, when I am writing a story, the illustrator isn't standing over my shoulder telling me what to write, and we do the same thing. We're very respectful.
I find this a fascinating artistic relationship. No, it's just right? Really interesting. First of all, and because it's contemporary, it can occur over many, many miles. You may never even physically talk to your partner. Yep. And what an amazing do you know any examples where it didn't go right for not you, but for other writers or artists? I mean, it's responsibility.
And I'm not telling you.
I'm not out looking for names. I'm not looking for names. I wouldn't do that to you, Heidi. But I mean, there are times when it doesn't work out, right?
Yeah. Well, but that is so far and few between, as far as I know. Most of my friends are either authors or illustrators, and there are some examples of relationships where the art director didn't mesh with the illustrator. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they send us several art samples and ask our opinion. Sometimes we cannot get our first choice. But I really, with my friends, with my close circle, there's never been anything where they said, well, here's my book and I hate the art. The artists in our business, the illustrators, are so brilliant.
Yeah.
I think it's just, we mostly just celebrate it. Are there some stories? Sure. But, they're very far and few between.
Now, when the story is sent to Eugenia in this one particular case, the story is completely written. You've written the book. So that's done for you. And then Eugenia has to work on deadline, right?
Yes. Sometimes we work on deadline, but much less so. We're sort of the front end, and then they decide. The illustrator, and then they decide what list it's going to be on. So is it going to be spring 2025? So then the artist gets that deadline.
Do you like working on deadline?
I actually do. I'll often give myself a deadline.
Yeah.
Right now I have a chapter book series I'm very excited about. And we're behind deadline. And I was just with my editor because we were teaching together. And we're behind deadline, but it's not my fault. She said, don't worry, this is not on you. She said, we're going to have to turn it around fast. And I said, I am fast. So I actually like working on deadline because it means I can't procrastinate. I can't procrastinate bake, procrastinate clean, procrastinate organize all the things I do, procrastinate laundry.
Oh, my God. I so identify.
I know, right? So it gives me some parameters to work in. And, I've been writing professional for 30 years now, but in a really real way, I've been in this business my whole life because my mother worked in it. So I understand it in a way that many people don't. I have a really broad view of it. So I like having those parameters in place so that I can I can set what I need to do when. I can say no to things because I have a deadline. I can lock myself in my office. I can run away to Highlights where I love to write, which is a foundation where picture book or kidlet writers go and work. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That sounds nice.
So it's lovely. I'm trying to. I just got back last night from there, but I was teaching other writers. We lock ourselves in cabins and are fed three meals a day and take hikes and just work. It's wonderful.
Oh, God. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Heidi E.Y. Stempel. She's published more than 35 books and numerous short stories and poems, mostly for young people. And her latest book that we're talking about is Wren's Nest. Now, Heidi, you also have several other books coming out this summer, including one I'm very excited about, She Sells Seashells.
This one's been a long time coming. I'm so excited about it.
Talk about it.
Okay, so a lot has been written about Mary Anning, but I got really interested in Mary Anning sort of in the feminist angle of her life. Now, if you don't know who Mary Anning is, that's okay. Mary Anning was a little girl here's the thing about books. When you've done the research, it's so long since you've done the research that you have to re-research before it comes out so you can answer questions. She lived in England in the early 1800s. Mm. And if you know the tongue twister, she sells seashells by the seashore. You know something about her. That's the title. She was born at a time when girls and women could collect pretty things, but they weren't scientists. Just so happens she lived in Lyme Regis, which was the area that we now call the Jurassic Coast, because so many fossils are there. And at the time she was there, they were really being uncovered by the sea. And her family had a curiosity shop. They sold shells and fossils and, you know, things that they found. Now, she was a young girl. She lost her father. She was really helping support the family. And the boys and the men of the time were buying fossils, her fossils, and studying them. It was the beginning of paleontology. It wasn't until 50 years after her death that women were even allowed in the Geological Society. So it's really about that fortitude of a young girl doing the work while the men are pontificating and studying and in the schools. And it's just, it's one of my favorite stories, and there is a lot written about her. So it was really about finding the story I wanted to tell.
I think she's so cool. Whenever I read about her when I was like, because I was, as most kids are now, but when I was a kid, which is like back in the Jurassic, but I read her story, and it was in some huge picture book about dinosaurs and fossils. Mm-hmm. And she discovered these marine fossils of these reptiles that lived in the ocean. And they were amazing. And it was at a time where people still didn't, the scientific people didn't still have a firm grasp on how old stuff could be. And she was just an amazing person. She was such a great role model for people.
She taught herself. And, you know, I make a lot about the feminist angle about it. She found one of the first pterosaurs. Mm. She found the first identified plesiosaur, the first ichthyosaur.
I know.
And these were just these amazing things. But she wasn't educated in any way. She was educating herself. There were men coming to buy her fossils, and they would give her some books. And she taught herself. She sat at her table and dissected cuttlefish and squid, I believe it was, and just copied the pages of the scientific texts so that she could learn to catalog and diagram herself. Wow. It was just really amazing. And I also point out in the book that the men and the boys are not the bad guys in the story. Culture was different.
Right.
But she really changed, I think, the way that people give credit and people, you know, to the way that we look at it backwards when we're looking back. In the last page of a picture book, a nonfiction picture book like this, you try to give an exit point. And it talks about what she opened up for people. I'm looking for this. So it's just one fossil at a time, one discovery at a time. Mary changed the scientific world forever. An unlikely paleontologist forged a path for every girl, for everyone curious enough to keep digging.
When is that going to be out?
July. July
16th. We may have to do another interview just about that book.
I'm there. It's funny because actually I have a huge interest in birds. I mean, obviously, right?
Well, I should add, I am in awe of your owling for the Northampton Christmas bird count. You got to talk about what you do, because and you always take a couple of photos while you're out too, but you know, you do the in the dark for hours. You're out there counting owls for the Northampton Christmas bird count, and I don't think they knew how many screech owls there were in that circle until you started doing this.
We really did figure out where they all were. Now, we had a little medical thing in the family, so I didn't manage to get out this past year. My crew, we call ourselves the OMG, the Owl Moon Gang, and they went out for me this year, and I was so grateful because it afforded me the time to do what was needed in the family crisis at the time. But after my dad died, I started going out and doing the Audubon Christmas Bird Count sort of by myself, and my dad's friends would come, and I have a friend who's a professor in Connecticut, and she would come just so that I wasn't alone.
Yeah.
Because I'd done it with my dad for so many years. And a couple years in, it started to shift after we lost my dad, and I started to allow friends who were more interested in birds to come with me, and then we just had this 1 year where it was amazing. So the people weren't just coming with me to make sure I was okay. They were people who wanted to come, and we just had this amazing year where we called in 67 owls.
I know that year. My jaw dropped.
Our jaws dropped. So the Christmas bird, let me back up. The Audubon Christmas bird count, for anyone who doesn't know, and you can find out about it in my book. Isn't that funny? Good segue, right?
Yes.
Counting Birds, which is for the youngest readers. The Christmas bird count was started by Frank Chapman. And the book begins, Frank Chapman loved birds. And he owned a magazine. He also worked for the Natural History Museum. He curated the bird account, the bird exhibits. His magazine was called Bird Lore. It is still out today, but now it's called Audubon Magazine. So see, it's this continuity here, right? But at the time, the Christmas bird census was people going out and shooting birds and counting them in a pile. They were called side hunts, and the winner of the side hunt, this count, was the person who shot and killed the most birds.
Oh,
Frank
God.
Chapman put in his magazine, if you spend part of your Christmas day doing a census without shooting them, I will put your name in my magazine and report what you did. And that first year, 27 birders in 25 locations from California to Connecticut did this. That was in the year 1900. Fast forward to today, we have over 80,000 people counting. I am one of them. I'm a specialist. I do owling. So I get up at midnight because that's the first minute of the count, and I count until dawn. So, yeah, and we have the numbers really depend on our roads, because I am going out to the Connecticut River. I live in a little town near the Connecticut River. We're out on farm roads. We are not calling owls in your backyard. We are counting owls a mile off the road.
And those roads can be bad.
They're horrific some years. And I drive a Honda Civic, so it's all about finding the right car to do it in. But it's for science. It's also for the stories. I remember my dad being at these meetings, and if he had found something interesting, and everybody does this, if he found something interesting, he'd hold back. He's like, I'm going to skip my turn. And that's what we did the year we counted all those owls. And when we came around, I said, Janice, who's our compiler, I said, I'd like to go last. Because I know it's a moment of storytelling. It's a moment of
being a weasel.
That you're side being, hunt,
you're,
right?
You're stealing the thunder from other people is what you're doing. I know these people.
It's exciting, but
it is great. It is great.
And years after that big year that we had, I found out, because we were on the radio together, that Dan Zomack on the other side of the Connecticut River in Hadley was in a deep competition with me. I didn't even know I was in a competition, but he knew. And he, in the last couple years, he has beat us in numbers.
Oh.
That's okay, because you know what? It's good for science. But trust me, every year now we go out, we're like, Zomack! And he knows it. We have the most friendly, lovely competition ever. And it's still, you can see how it's still that competition. But now the results are, we're not shooting birds. We're doing it for science. It's the longest running citizen science project in the
That's
world,
right.
And others have come from it, and the information from it has lasting and large implications. What species are in trouble? What species need habitat revival or preservation? What climate change is doing to which birds? That sort of thing. As all those numbers are there for the scientists doing that work.
I do three Christmas counts. I used to do five. Now I'm really old, and that just frightens me. I used to do two coastal counts, and I live in Worcester, so that was like a whole long thing to have to do. But I love your I love your owl reports, because it really shows what you can do if you have a dedicated owling team. And every Christmas kind of circle leader always wants to get the people out owling, and everybody says, yeah, right, whatever. And people do minimal owling. That's the truth. And so you just show everybody up, and it's amazing.
We're just like, we're going out. We're going to be out. And I make lists and charts so that we can check them off when we're going. We don't count along the way. We just hash mark it. But here's the important part for me.
Okay, we got 2 minutes left.
Okay, I have told so many children about the Audubon Christmas bird count, and I call owls with kids in schools. And for me, it's so important to share that with kids.
Again, we have like 1 minute left. Have you seen a decline in great horned owls? Or you still have as many as you always did?
They kind of come and go, and they don't call back to you if you call.
Yeah.
They don't care about you. And you can hear them, you know, like you can call up a screech owl.
Oh, yeah.
You just got to find the great horned owls.
You can also call up barred owls, but what will happen is they'll fly in and sit
silently,
and then all of a sudden wail. And you didn't know they're there, and will scare the living daylights out of you. Oh my God!
My friend Lynn and I. Lynn is in the OMG, the Owl Moon Gang.
Oh,
she and I jumped and dove into the minivan. We were driving a minivan that year, and dove into it because a barred owl screamed at us. We were sure we were going
to
be.
We're going to have you back just to talk about. We got to talk about how you became a children's book author. Because that's a whole story. Don't talk about it. We're going to have you back talking about She Sells Seashells. My guest tonight has been Heidi E.Y. Stempel. She's published more than 35 books and numerous short stories, poems that we even get to talk about. We'll talk about it next time, mostly for young people. And her latest one, it is gorgeous. It is a beautiful book. It's a great story, Wren's Nest. Heidi, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.